This is Dr. Patty Shelton, and you are listening to the LongevIQ podcast. We discuss anti-aging and longevity science and how to benefit from it so we can all live long, healthy, happy lives. Just before we get started, a quick medical disclaimer. This podcast is for informational purposes only. It is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease or to provide or replace medical advice. Please use this information to educate yourself as much as possible and share this information with a qualified health practitioner that you trust. In this episode, we'll go over some of the key aging mechanisms that play a major role in the way that we age. Known in the literature as the hallmarks of aging, these changes represent our most current understanding of the aging process and how it affects our bodies. But do we know enough yet to benefit from all of this research? Can we slow down or even reverse any of these processes? And if so, where do we get started? Our guest today is Dr. Anil Bajnath, MD, a functional precision medicine physician and an expert in anti-aging and longevity. We'll start with an overview of the hallmarks of aging, and then we'll look into practical things we can all do that can influence these aging processes. Also joining us today, as always, is Amir Ginsberg, the founder of LongevIQ. Welcome, Dr. Bajnath. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We wanted to talk today about the hallmarks of aging. And this is something that you discuss really in detail in your book and in some of your work at the university. So we would love if you would give us an overview of what are these hallmarks of aging.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. The hallmarks of aging refers to a consensus amongst the scientific literature that's mapped out these 9 fundamental hallmarks that regulate the biological aging process. And as we know, there are multiple different factors that contribute to age-related chronic diseases. And what we have found is that there are different levels of these hallmarks that influence each and every clinical disease imbalance or pathology. And these hallmarks are all intertwined. And this kind of stems from a paper that was published back in 2010 with Lopez et al. In, I believe it's Cellular Biology. Him and his team really mapped out and gathered the literature and synthesized all this into what is now conventionally accepted as the hallmarks of aging. And these hallmarks are broken down into different subcategories and are all interrelated, like I said, to one another. We have these 4 core primary hallmarks, which cause the bulk of the damage. And we have a couple of antagonistic hallmarks that lead into these integrative hallmarks, each one kind of compounding and leading into one another. If we look at aging as a process as a whole, there's multiple different factors that influence the body's ability to, number one, accumulate the damage over a lifetime, and number two, repair the damage. And as we get older, sometimes that checks and balances is dysregulated and we start accumulating more damage and we lose the ability to repair. Looking at this through the lens of the hallmarks of aging, I think is important. And it's a fun topic of discussion because it's the foundations to aging as a whole. And as we know, we also have this concept of biological age versus chronological age, where our biological age is what's happening on the inside. And chronologically or calendar age, we could be in our 30s, 40s, or whatever, but biologically, we could be even younger than that, just because we've done our homework to really help with the self-preservation, mitigating exposure to damage and undoing some of the damage that we are exposed to over a lifetime. Now, just starting off with one of the primary hallmarks of aging is looking at what is known as genetic instability. So as we get older, we accumulate genetic damage through our lives, and it's very important to understand where this damage is coming from. This could be endogenous or from within, and sometimes it can be coming from exogenous. For example, endogenous genetic instability could come from free radical damage that leads to reactive nitrogenous species in our system that is pretty genotoxic. Also, another pretty genotoxic, commonly found metabolite is 4-hydroxyestrone. As estrogen is metabolized in the liver, it could lead to these different estrogen metabolites. And the 4-hydroxyestrone is most noted for being genotoxic and the one that is behind driving cancer formation. There are multiple different factors that lead to genetic instability. And it's important to look at that and try to identify these different endogenous and exogenous factors, mitigate that exposure. Generally speaking, genomic instability and its root cause for aging goes into basically the DNA structure. If you were to look at DNA, the double helix, it's basically, as we all know, a complete set of instructions that we're all born with, 50% inherited by our biological mother, the other 50% from our biological father. And we know that there's approximately 3 billion base pairs that comprise of approximately 25,000 genes. Now, as we get older and our cells are replicating, the ability to repair DNA when it's exposed to these different reactive oxygen and nitrogenous species and other chemicals that we're exposed to becomes a little bit taxed. We have what's called DNA proofreading repair enzymes that are very important for these cell cycle checkpoints and to make sure that before the cell moves into the next phase of replication, that it has not accumulated too much damage and it's able to repair any of those nucleotide bases that might have occurred through mutation. So the primary hallmark, again, starting off with genomic instability, and there are multiple different factors that could lead to those genotoxic exposures.
So starting with those four primary hallmarks, the first one being genomic instability, what's the next one?
Well, the next one is telomere attrition. If you were to picture your DNA as shoelaces, and at the end of our shoelaces, we know that there are these little caps at the end. Now, as we get older, every year, our telomeres, the little caps on the end of our DNA, begins to weather and frail. And we actually lose telomerase activity at a very notable rate. And that rate of telomere attrition or shortening of the telomeres plays a very important role because telomeres in general are very important for keeping the DNA structure, function, and integrity intact. There are various proteins and enzymes that are involved that are responsible for just making sure that there is no accumulated damage taking place on those ends of the telomeres. So a telomere starts to fray and become shorter. They start to resemble broken DNA. As they become more broken, they're more likely to be targeted by a process known as DNA damage response, which ultimately could lead to cell death. Shorter telomeres is associated with accelerated aging and disease. The enzyme that we try to preserve is known as telomerase. That basically helps maintain chromosomal length, and it's found in various cells and tissues. It's most notably found in lower concentrations in somatic cells, which are any cells other than reproductive cells, and higher concentrations in stem cells and germ cells like egg and sperm. As we get older, there are multiple different factors that influence our telomere activity. And there's some things that we could do to maintain our telomere length with pretty strong evidence, most notably exercise. Exercise is one of those things that has been shown to really help support telomere structure, function, and integrity. Stress reduction, maintaining a healthy weight, healthy diet, smoking cessation are all different interventions that could be used to help preserve our telomerase activity. Additionally, there was a very fascinating publication that came out 2 years ago from Israel that looked at the role of hyperbaric oxygen therapy at boosting telomerase activity, and that's been fairly reproducible in human clinical trials. And then there's other compounds out there that are promoted for helping with telomerase activity, and that includes a compound known as TA65. TA65 is an alkaloid that's derived from Chinese medicine herb called astragalus. And astragalus is a herb that's known as an adaptogen, but also has different benefits for the pulmonary system and the lungs used traditionally in Chinese medicine. And that's a compound that has some evidence to support that it's been shown to increase telomerase activity as a whole. And that leads into another primary hallmark, which is looking at what's known as epigenetic alterations. Now, epigenetics is basically the gene-environmental interface. So far with these primary hallmarks, they're all centered around our structure, function, and integrity of the genome. So making sure that there's no instability, that the ends of the genome and the telomeres are maintained, and then looking at what leads to epigenetic alteration. Epigenetics literally means above the gene, and it's not necessarily changing your DNA, but it has the potential to influence how your genes are being expressed. It's almost like the volume control of how certain genes are upregulated or downregulated in expression due to various environmental signals. And there's various signals that could drive various gene expression. On a molecular level, this has to do with methylation, acetylation, deacetylation, and all those other factors that could potentially influence the gene's ability to wrap around what's known as these histone proteins. Histones are these little arginine-rich bases that basically allow the gene to wrap around. And sometimes, as the gene needs to upregulate a specific signal, it will unravel and then get to the point where the gene needs to be expressed, either deacetylate, methylate, or acetylate that specific gene for various function and response to whatever signal it's responding to. I definitely think that epigenetics is one of our greatest abilities to harness the ability to really influence how our genes behave based on the various signals and inputs that our body is receiving. This could lead into like something known as chronobiology and looking at various peripheral signals in the environment that influence our body's internal clock regulation. But generally speaking, with epigenetics, there's so many different factors that could influence it. Diet, nutrition, stress, exercise, all of these have the ability to influence our gene expression and turn up and down various forms of genetic regulation and volume control. Again, one of the greatest opportunities for us on a daily basis is to try to feed ourselves healthy quality information so that we can enhance our favorable gene expression. A classic example is going to be diet. You know, if a diet is rich in pro-inflammatory foods, it's going to have the ability to influence these different nuclear response elements. Nuclear factor kappa beta is going to be upregulated with inflammatory signaling due to some of the foods that we eat. And that could have a whole host of downstream inflammatory cytokinetic response due to that. So again, there's multiple different factors that could influence how our bodies respond to these different stresses, with food being one of our greatest opportunities to enhance our favorable gene expression, which leads to the primary hallmark, loss of proteostasis. And this has to do with a decline in the quality of proteins that keep our cells doing what they need to do. After decades of toxins from the environment and our food assaulting our cells, they could become damaged. And your body has a natural defense against these damaged cells, and that's called autophagy. Autophagy really helps remove some of these damaged accumulated proteins. Another important factor that leads to the removal of these accumulated proteins is sleep. So at nighttime, when we go to sleep, we have this internal hydraulic pump that lives within our cerebral spinal fluid, known as the glymphatic system. And the glymphatic system wipes away and washes away from the neuron all the alpha synuclein, beta amyloid, and tau tangle proteins. And it's been shown that just one night of sleep disruption could lead to higher concentrations of these protein metabolites that could accumulate and lead to loss of proteostasis in the body. And this is most notably involved with neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And this is actually one of the last primary hallmarks in our list before we get into the next phases of the hallmarks, the antagonistic hallmarks. The antagonistic hallmarks are the responses to the damage from the primary hallmarks. So the primary hallmarks are the ones that really cause the damage. The antagonistic hallmarks are the defensive mechanisms that are come into response due to that. The first antagonistic hallmark is known as dysregulated nutrient signaling. Your body has this built-in nutrient sensing system that its only job is to make sure that you're eating enough healthy nutrients. As you age, these systems start to break down and have a hard time determining what you need. Years of eating processed foods, unnatural foods, put added stress on these nutrient sensors and cause us to age faster. Our hypothalamus can be affected, causing us to become hungrier than normal and eat too many calories, which further degrades the nutrient sensing systems. One of these dysregulated nutrient signaling could be linked to leptin resistance, for example. With chronic inflammation, our body produces this neuropeptide known as leptin, and it binds to the archaeate nucleus in the hypothalamus and signals feelings of satiety or feeling full. And sometimes with chronic inflammation in our system, our body starts to become resistant to the leptin, and we no longer have that signal saying, hey, stop eating, right? So that's one example of how dysregulated nutrient signaling could influence our body's ability to respond to normal cues to feeding. Other signals also include IGF signaling in regards to different growth factors in the body, either being fed or fasting. And when we're in a fed state, there's different molecules that are upregulated, different proteins in the liver and everything else, and different signals, including IGF, which could be upregulated in response to being in a fed state. Being in a fasting state, as we've spoken before in previous discussions, could influence our mTOR signaling, the mammalian target of rapamycin. And when we're in a fasting state, it's been shown that we upregulate something called AMP kinase, and that has the ability to inhibit the mTOR, and the mTOR turns on that molecular master switch to signaling autophagy. Another very important antagonistic hallmark is mitochondrial dysfunction. As we know, mitochondria are the powerhouses of the cell, and we actually inherit our mitochondrial DNA from our mother. It's where we generate the energy to carry on with normal jobs of our body. The ATP production, or energy production coming from these organelles, is what keeps us going. Time and free radical damage could lead to damage accumulation to the mitochondria and lead to less energy production, making your cells slower and more lethargic. This decline is most often seen first in tissues with high energy demand, like the brain and heart. This is one of the reasons our mental function faculties decline as we get older, and this hallmark has become a major focus of anti-aging research. If we can keep our cells powered, they can keep doing their jobs for longer and keep us healthier in this process. And that leads to inflammaging. And inflammaging could be coming from multiple different factors. And in my clinical practice, we use a form of testing called transcriptomic testing, which actually looks at how the DNA is behaving through assessing RNA function, looking at what genes are kind of upregulated or downregulated. And one of the things that I see all day with this test, unfortunately, is something called molecular hypometabolism, which has to deal with something called cell danger response. And cell danger response in the literature refers to when a cell perceives some sort of environmental threat, it takes on a defensive posturing where the allocation of energy and the triaging of energy is shifted away from being healthy, vibrant cells and manufacturing enough ATP to keep us healthy and vibrant. But it goes in towards becoming little battleships. And those little battleships take on that defensive posturing because of this perceived threat in the environment. So again, if we're living and being exposed to these different environmental threats, whether there's infections or viruses or mold, most often is what I see, the mold could cause this cell danger response, and it could lead to a host sequelae of dampening mitochondrial function. Also, one of the things that I think is really important as we discuss autophagy is the concept of mitophagy, right? Mitophagy is basically the recycling of the mitochondria and going in there and turning on that molecular master switch of triggering autophagy and the recycling of these various organelles. Organelles are basically the little structures within the cell. And there's so many different things that could lead to mitochondrial dysfunction and uncoupling and mitochondrial damage, just chemicals and toxins in the environment. And there's a whole laundry list of different toxins that we all know of, from the cosmetic products that we use topically to the cleaning products in our home, the cooking utensils that we have, the way our food is grown and harvested and prepared, preserved, and so forth. All of those could have an effect on mitochondrial function. So that's a very important hallmark. And again, there's so many different things and supplements out there that's been shown to help with mitochondrial structure, function, and integrity. That's a whole nother lecture that I could get into, looking at PQQ and CoQ10, lipoic acid, and, you know, looking at the different complexes within the mitochondria that's needed for ATP production. We'll save that for another deeper dive another day on mitochondrial structure function. What's also really interesting about mitochondria is that it's higher in cells that have the most metabolic machinery. So our heart and our brain are loaded with mitochondria as well. And with time, you know, it could lead to dampening mitochondrial function, lead to the symptoms of fatigue and neurocognitive issues. But another very interesting concept from an evolutionary biology perspective is what is known as the endosymbiotic theory of how we acquired mitochondria from a theoretical evolutionary perspective. It is said that these mitochondria used to be a bacteria that was living in the environment, a cyanobacteria more specifically. specifically. And eons ago, somehow our cell engulfed that bacteria. And since then, there's been this symbiotic relationship between the mitochondria and the rest of the cell to help with production of energy. And this is very interesting because some of the subunits found within the mitochondria get damaged with certain antibiotics, for example. Very interesting stuff. The last antagonistic hallmark, which is my favorite topic, deals with cellular senescence. As we've spoken about this before, cellular senescence refers to cells that have reached their end mitotic division or accumulated enough damage over time where the cell is no longer able to divide appropriately and is not removed from circulation through programmed cell death or apoptosis and through the immune system. And as these cells accumulate, these senescent cells, the cell releases these different proteins known as SAS proteins or senescent associated secretory proteins or phenotype. And those proteins accelerate the aging process. Hence the zombie effect, that it's spewing out these toxic metabolites, accelerating conversion of other cells in the neighborhood to transform into senescent cells. We could find these cells accumulated in every single organ and tissue, our immune system, our brain, our heart, our lung, our kidney, everywhere. And these cells is area of research right now that researchers are really trying to take a deeper dive into to see if removing these cells aggressively through pharmacological interventions will have an age reversal effect. So far, the studies are quite promising, but should be used very responsibly. And as we know, there are different lifestyle factors that we could implement right now to empower ourselves to help remove these senescent cells. That includes, as we discussed before, intermittent fasting or fasting as a whole to turn on that upregulation of AMP kinase, which inhibits the mTOR and then turns on the autophagy. And autophagy is that cellular recycling pathway that we've discussed today. It's good to turn on the garbage disposal switch, right? To clear out all the debris that's accumulated in the system. We've discussed different compounds that could help support AMP kinase signaling, including berberin, fisetin, quercetin. And there's different pharmaceutical agents, including dasatinib and rapamycin that is being used to help with turning on of the switch, so to speak. So that's cellular senescence and the last of those antagonistic hallmarks, which leads to the last two hallmarks, the integrative hallmarks. These lead to the culprits of a pathophenotype, meaning, you know, once these are kind of in motion, it really leads to disease and dysfunction. The first integrative hallmark deals with stem cell exhaustion. Now, as we know, stem cells are these blank slates, and they are able to give rise to any other forms of cells. They have the ability to go into different forms and lead to growth and regeneration. There's very interesting research behind various factors of these stem cells as we get older, and research right now on rejuvenating some of these factors have been shown to help turn on stem cells. Once again, endogenously, without having to take other stem cells. It's still in its infancy, but this refers to the Yamanaka factors, basically these theories of genes that have been shown to be downregulated and influence stem cell exhaustion. But there are different things that could help with stem cell mobilization. And I think a lot of this has to deal with the microenvironment. Taking more of a philosophical approach to aging, sometimes, you know, we need to look at the body as a micro ecosystem or terrain. If that terrain is nurtured and we remove all the excess sugar, fat, salt, protein, and so forth, and we keep the microorganisms happy, there's no overgrowth, and we're doing enough physical activity and exercise to stimulate stem cells, to stimulate repair and growth, there's a nice homeodynamic balance between degeneration and regeneration. And there are multiple different things, pharmaceutical agents and interventions that are being investigated right now for helping with stem cell exhaustion, with Yamanaka factors beyond the highest level. That's a whole nother conversation and definitely worth looking into for a deep dive. But again, stem cell exhaustion leads to the inability for us to repair ourselves. That accelerates the body's aging process and inability to recover from any damage that's been accumulated, which leads into the last hallmark, altered extracellular communication. Altered extracellular communication has to deal with how cells communicate amongst one another. If there's dysregulation in communication, communication due to the signaling molecules that are upregulated, for example, SASP proteins, those senescent-associated proteins, or they're inflammatory cytokines, and there's a pro-inflammatory cytokinetic milieu or environment, that's going to have an ability for these cells to miscommunicate. When there's miscommunication, there are all sorts of things that could go awry, including the potential for cancer and autoimmunity. So this is where we lose the ability to recognize self, you know, in autoimmune conditions, where now all of a sudden our immune system is like, oh, we're attacking these different tissues that are our self, and we've lost the ability to differentiate between self and not self, which is not good. And once we have that altered extracellular communication, and we don't have the ability to recognize self from non-self, and we lose the additional autoregulatory capacity to remove damaged cells from our system, and they escape apoptosis or programmed cell death, and they now gain some oncogenic activity, or they have a loss of tumor suppressor activity. Now we need it, you know, we're concerned about cancer growth and proliferation. So there's a lot of different factors that come out of this hallmark.
That is fantastic. Wow. So much information. Let me see if I can just summarize really quick, you know, the hallmarks that you've just shared to kind of remind everybody, and then we can talk about how they're all related to each other. So you had the primary hallmarks, the genomic instability, so damage to the DNA coming from inside and outside cells. You had telomeres, the little caps on the ends of chromosomes kind of wearing away slowly over time. You had epigenetic changes, so changes in how genes are expressed in the body. And then changes in proteostasis or loss of proteostasis, so abnormal proteins building up and causing damage, right? So those are our primary hallmarks. And then there were the antagonistic hallmarks, so where the body's protective mechanisms are being damaged or lost. So nutrient sensing is no longer functioning well. We might eat too much food. We might not get enough nutrients into the right cells in the body. Changes in the mitochondria, so little power factories in the cell no longer able to do what they need to do. And then cellular senescence, so like old zombie cells that can't divide anymore, building up in the body. And then we led into the integrative hallmarks, where everything comes together, which is exhaustion of the stem cells. So the cells that are like the sources of healing and rejuvenation for tissues, those are no longer there for us, no longer able to do what they need to do. And then changes in how cells communicate with each other. So cells are no longer able to work together and function well as a whole. Yeah. Is that a good kind of summary of what we're all talking about?
Absolutely.
We can see how these things might interact with each other, but maybe talk a little bit about how an action on one hallmark might feed both backwards and forwards into different ones, or how the hallmarks are related.
I think it has to deal with a lot of lifestyle factors. You know, aging is very integrally related to diet and lifestyle. I've spoken about historically the unitary theory of the fundamentals of aging, which highlights the interdependence among the hallmarks of aging. Intervening in one fundamental aging process, it will have influence and impact on all other processes. For us to sit here and say we're going to target stem cells and telomeres and everything else through a specific isolated nutrient, I think is myopic in perspective and approach to graceful aging. I think that when it comes down to it, a lot of this is going to be lifestyle driven, making sure that we're mitigating any potential exposure or damage that could lead to genomic instability, accelerate telomere attrition, lead to the epigenetic alterations, and ultimately loss of proteostasis, you know, and those primary causative factors. So mitigating exposure to these different environmental factors is critical. And that's where it's like, all right, maybe we should eat certain foods organic. I don't want to get too crazy with it, but you know, there's a clean 15 and the dirty dozen put out by the Environmental Working Group. And I know there are criticisms on how reliable that is and the accumulation of these different herbicides, fungicides, pesticides that leads to endocrine disruption. But one thing to take into consideration is how was your food grown and harvested. Additionally, if you do eat meat, was that grass fed, grass finished? Was there hormones, antibiotics in the life of that animal that kind of carries over? I'm seeing individuals that are exposed to these environmentally acquired illnesses, mold with mycotoxins, endotoxins from bacteria, and even a very ubiquitous bacteria that I find quite often in my testing called actinomycetes. So looking at the relationship of our environment, the immune system, the a potential infectious process? Do we have stealth infections festering below our normal immunological surveillance capacity to address this issue? For example, chronic Epstein-Barr virus, which could also have an effect on all of this in terms of mitochondrial function and dysregulated immune response with accelerating immunosenescence. So infections have the ability to accelerate that. Epigenetics, again, I think diet is going to be your greatest opportunity. Eating organic, eating healthy, very important. Eating across a rainbow with the different flavonoids, polyphenols, and so forth, and those different phytonutrients actually affect cellular function. You know, those phytonutrients bind to G protein coupled receptors and actually have an influence on signal transduction on a molecular level to influence gene expression. Doing things like fasting could help with dysregulated nutrient signaling and cellular senescence and loss of proteostasis. Targeting one of these hallmarks through supplements could have some benefit. There's research now that's emerging that's looking at, you know, different types of drugs and medications that could be used to help dealing with the senescent cell. There are different medications and supplements that could help mitochondrial function. Exercise, right? And its effect on telomeres. Hyperbaric oxygen is another really great tool. I have a hyperbaric oxygen chamber in my practice. That's one of those tools that could really help out with increasing oxygenation of the tissue, which thereby leads to an upregulation in our body's endogenous antioxidant systems. And then on the horizon, the different stem cell interventions are to come, whether it's actually going for stem cell therapy on yourself, autologous or otherwise, or exogenous stem cells, looking at your chronobiology and chronorhythm, which deals with how your body is feeding, fasting, sleeping, and all these different light cues and signals. And that discordance, I think, is the beginning of triggering these downstream hallmarks when there's an environmental gene mismatch from the chronobiology and the stress and the accumulation of that stress and that dysregulation that could ultimately just make our reserve less vital. Also, genetics plays a very important role. Everybody is dealt their own unique hand of gene inheritance patterns. Some people have won the genetic lottery and others have not. And it's very interesting how that influences aging as a whole. There's been a couple of genes that have been mapped out that have been associated with longevity. So there are multiple factors there. And then looking at how we could help decreasing or turning down the inflammatory volume control of all those inflammatory proteins. Because again, inflammation could be linked to every single hallmark here as well.
What you're saying is the 9 hallmarks of aging aren't actually the 9 causes of aging, but more like 9 mechanisms by which things in our environment and things in our body are impacting how aging shows up ultimately in our lives. So what if somebody said, okay, there's 9 hallmarks of aging. How do I test where I am in each and every one of these 9? Do we need to test every single one of them? Is that even meaningful to do since they impact each other? Is there a way to do that?
No, I use a test, no affiliation, you know, with this company, and I have no financial interests or anything, but I like to get the true diagnostic, true age test for my patients that are going through my longevity program. It establishes a really nice biological age baseline, and it also looks at the rate of stem cell replication per year, your telomerase activity. It gives you an idea of immunosenescence. And it's also looking at epigenetic alterations. So it kind of really hits on a lot of these different hallmarks. Looking at these different commercially available tests, True Age from True Diagnostic is the one that I personally really love using because they actually break down methylation patterns on various specific genes and those different factors, which could tell you if there's any epigenetic alterations in key CpG islands that are influencing specific pathways. I really like looking at the biological age to see if we're accelerated in our aging process. I also like to look at the telomere component and the stem cell replication component. Those all tell us where we fall based on averages of the population and the rate of aging and everything else. So to me, that's probably the best test that I have. But I also use that in conjunction with another software in my practice. We actually get a phenotypical age report card where we measure your lung function and we look at arterial stiffness to get your biological age on your different tissues. So that's kind of like the baseline of how I like to map and see where my patients are at. The goal is, all right, let's have fun at reversing our biological age objectively. And we have data to support that. All those different tools are what I use clinically to assess hallmarks of aging, surrogates of hallmarks, and age as a whole. to establish that baseline.
And do you normally see that all 9 hallmarks are roughly proceeding at the same rate? Or might somebody see, for example, their telomeres are still really long, but their epigenetic aging has proceeded super rapidly? Might there be a mismatch like that?
There are mismatches. And again, these are more so composites and comparisons to the general population. The stem cell mitotic number tells you the rate compared to others. Same thing with the telomerase activity. It gives you kind of a percentile number of how you compare to cohorts of a similar age and where you land in that process. And ideally, you want to maintain really good stem cell activity and really good telomerase activity and so forth. But there is some discordance where I've seen people with really dampened stem cell function, pretty darn good telomerase function, and still accelerated aging on epigenetic level. There's all sorts of different mismatches. Then you look at the lifestyle of this individual and you're like, all right, well, you know, you're 64 years old, but you're biologically 71. Your stem cells seem to be really pooping out on us. And we need to look at, well, are you active? For example, grip strength is one of the most important things fitness-wise and a very important surrogate marker for longevity. And again, you got to look at also the different wellness wheel, like, you know, sleep, diet, nutrition, exercise, meaning and purpose, relationships, all those different factors need to be optimized. And if one of those are dysregulated, you know, it's going to have a downstream effect on everything else. If you stop exercising, you find yourself restless in your sleep, or if you eat very poorly and you start gaining weight and you lack motivation, or there's a high stress day and alcohol consumption, which leads to poor sleep and then caffeine the next day, all these different things. It's super dynamic. And it's interesting to see how that is also further captured with wearable data and biometrics, like an Oura ring or something of that nature. I love my Oura ring. And I use this with my patients as well to look at the HRVs and some patterns over time. And you could oftentimes link these different lifestyle stress factors into patterns of dysfunction, which leads to behaviors that leads to patterns of dysfunction that sometimes could have rippling effects that could take days to undo that damage.
On that kind of a note, when somebody discovers that their biological age is higher than their chronological age and they want to address that, they want to slow down that aging, how quickly can we impact the rate of aging? How quickly could somebody's changes in lifestyle or supplements or things like that actually begin to bring down that biological age so that it's maybe in line with or even less than the chronological age?
There are 2-3 major studies out there right now that really broke that down. There was Dr. Fahey and his trial that looked at a couple of different interventions, including growth hormone, DHEA, vitamin D, and metformin, and its effect on biological aging process. Then there was Dr. Kara Fitzpatrick's publication on biological aging in regards to using nutritional interventions. And all of them are studying a smaller population at that. My approach to things is everything is individualized, N of one. But with research right now in medicine, everything is like, what's the end value? How many people are participating in the study? What kind of outcomes do we get collectively? And you're just trying to mash up all sorts of data and endpoints. When it comes down to it, looking at the person in front of you, your genetics is completely different. And the way you clinically respond to even drugs and medications is going to be different than the other person. So I like to use these age-related tests to paint that baseline. And then I like to take a deep dive by looking at your genetic blueprint. I also look at sometimes that transcript proteomic blueprint. I look at proteomics, metabolomics, microbiome, and all of that data and put it together. So my private practice with the Institute for Human Optimization is kind of a clinical manifestation of the courses that I teach at George Washington University. Course director of the Omics of Medicine class, I'm teaching other fellows that are going for their boards in integrative medicine how to connect the molecular dots from genome to pathophenome. So I like to use this data to personalize a protocol for people. To answer your question, you could sometimes see a shifting of the needle within 6 months. And it's not one thing that we're going to do, but a culmination of things that we could do objectively. But I would not recommend doing the true age diagnostic test less than 6 months in between intervention to see a notable signal.
And do you normally then check it every 6 months, or once you see it sort of stabilize, maybe you just don't need to test again for a while?
It's very individualized because this testing is not cheap and it's not covered by insurance. So it really just depends on the individual. I like to at least get a baseline and then try to check it at very minimum annually. Certain individuals have access to more resources than others, and they're proactive with their health, and they want to get ahead of the curve and want to make sure that the intervention has a positive signal. But I typically recommend every 6 to 12 months.
Amir, did you have any questions that you'd like to add into the mix here?
We mentioned a lot of testing. But are there any common symptoms that are associated with some hallmarks? For example, low energy, mitochondria problems, et cetera?
When it comes down to determining whether there's a cause and effect relationships with the specific hallmarks in a clinical manifestation or a symptomatic manifestation, like you said, one of the things that I see molecularly is downregulated mitochondrial function or mitochondrial dysfunction and fatigue. And that could be on a neuronal level and symptomatically manifests itself as early neurofatigue, inability to focus, decreased assimilation of new knowledge, confusion, disorientation. Mitochondria as a whole could be associated with that. Also, stem cell exhaustion could be, you go to the gym and you just can't recover. You're not mobilizing and recovering and regenerating like we used to. It could also be a manifestation of brittle bones and all sorts of osteoblastic-like activity on a bone level or fibroblastic activity on a tissue level. Even aches and pains could be associated with some of those hallmarks. Dysregulated nutrient sensing, you know, I mentioned the leptin resistance, the role of feeding and fasting, and diabetes or diabesity is another classical example of an accelerated aging process. Literally, when you're measuring hemoglobin A1C, you're measuring the advanced glycated end products or ages. It's not a hallmark of aging, those ages, but it's actually a mechanism of aging where it's looking at the cross-linking of various sugars and proteins on a cellular level, leading to insulin receptor site resistance. Not good. And that also further shifts the body's ability to triage and process energy appropriately. Epigenetically, it's hard to say, oh, this is an epigenetic symptom, but what I see on a transcriptomic level, looking at specific genes that might be potentially upregulated due to inflammation. I sometimes see a HIF1A upregulated, and that is very important for the cardiopulmonary circuitry. And people that have HIF1A upregulation in their transcriptomic profile are more susceptible to decreased exercise tolerance, shortness of breath, pulmonary hypertension, because they're clamping down on the vasculature. It's multifactorial on the symptomatic manifestation. There's multiple hallmarks of aging that influence disease manifestation. So if you were to take a disease like diabetes, there could be at least 8 of these hallmarks that are involved and could be connected to the pathophysiological processes of type 2 diabetes. Same thing with Alzheimer's. You know, you can connect some of those dots there and see how each hallmark could have a role in disease development.
As we've talked, you've mentioned a few lifestyle factors or ways that people can impact lots of these hallmarks all at once. Exercise impacts many different ones. Sleep impacts many different ones. I know this is a huge, huge, huge topic, but maybe a little summary of how a few really high impact activities might act on various hallmarks of aging. Some things we can do that might impact maybe multiple different hallmarks all at once, or ones that might impact even one specific one really strongly.
A lot of this has to deal with diet and lifestyle, right? And I think that's going to be one of our greatest opportunities to have the greatest impact on some of these hallmarks of aging. And I got to say that there's really great evidence about intermittent fasting. New England Journal of Medicine had a wonderful publication that looked at 18-6 intermittent fasting and its association with longevity and cancer reduction. It's not every day that New England Journal of Medicine is discussing that. So right off the bat, adapting intermittent fasting kind of lifestyle, 18-6 at baseline. And it shouldn't be too hard to do. You finish dinner around 6 p.m., you have your first meal around 12 the following day. Shouldn't be that difficult. Maybe you squeeze in some gentle exercise and activity in the morning while fasting to have a greater thermogenic effect. It's going to work on dysregulated nutrient signaling, loss of proteostasis. It has effect on epigenetics and also cellular senescence. And back to the food conversation, eating foods that are colorful and across a rainbow. I'm sipping on a smoothie right now that has every single color in it. If you were to actually break down these different foods and more so phytonutrients, you're going to see that every single pigmentation has a different alkaloid that has a different therapeutic clinical benefit. And the only way we could get these alkaloids into our system or these phytonutrients is through consuming these foods. And I know some will say, oh, but the sugar. I've seen other things spike my blood glucose on CGM versus a smoothie. When I am tracking my continuous glucose monitor, this is not spiking my blood sugar at all. So I'm maintaining a nice flat curve. But what I put in my smoothie is blackberries, blueberries, and we know Those berries are loaded with phytonutrients that have been shown to help with all sorts of age-related changes, blueberries for the brain and all sorts of stuff. Raspberries, you know, raspberries are a really rich source of ellagic acid, and ellagic acid is really important for protecting the blood vessels and the vascular system. Strawberries, so more darker reds and pigmentations and purples and black. And then I put in there two oranges, a banana, so some orange and yellow. And then I have a green powder that has all sorts of grasses in there that I like to use. And then I put in a really clean veggie protein that I get from Whole Foods Market, no flavor. And I put the base of coconut water. And I love coconut water. Coconut water is essentially doing a liquid IV. It's loaded with magnesium and potassium. I do the unsweetened acai, so there's no sugar in that. I also put spinach in it. But yeah, that's the foundation to the smoothies that I have almost daily. I just feel good doing this. It just supercharges me. And then, you know, dinner comes around 5 o'clock and I have my first meal. My pattern so far today, I woke up, I was able to get a little bit of sleep. I have a newborn. I went to the gym, had an incredible workout. And then that carried on to about 18 hours of fasting because I finished dinner around 6 p.m. yesterday. And then I had my nutrient-rich smoothie. And then I'm going to have a meal this afternoon. I try to lean into a kind of a whole food plant-based meal. I will infuse some fish and seafood into my diet because if you're to look at the blue zones and the centenarians and the research around that, they're eating primarily a whole food plant-based diet. They will infuse some fish here and there. They will do some meat here and there. They're not rigid or incredibly restrictive, but there is a strong emphasis on whole food and plant-based dieting. So that's something that I do personally. I also recommend supplements. I really like CoQ10. I do like the omega-3s. Are there supplements that I take to help with targeting some of these hallmarks? I take berberine. I find that it has tremendous benefits with improving insulin sensitivity and other metabolic benefits, as well as helping with cholesterol. And it's been shown to have some mild PCSK9 inhibition. Sleep is critical, right? Clearing out those accumulated proteins that have lost their structure, function, and integrity. Sleep is one of the things that I try to prioritize. And now that I have the newborn, what I'm doing is just trying to get to bed even earlier, knowing that the sleep is going to be disrupted throughout the night. So that's how I'm trying to gauge it. I've got the Oura Ring data to support that I'm not crashing horribly. You know, I used to hit optimals regularly. Now it's very seldom, but it's not horrible in the sleep number comparatively. I like to lift weights a few times a week. I do my sauna a couple times a week. Sauna has been shown to help with all sorts of benefits, including BDNF, mobilizing toxins out of your system, and cardioprotective benefits as well. So I do sauna 3 to 5 times a week, generally speaking. I love to train Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. That's something that I've been doing since I was in high school, and it's just my personal passion. So I've infused Jiu-Jitsu, weightlifting, sauna as part of my physical activity, on top of like other things that I have in my garage, rowing and boxing and all sorts of other fun stuff. So movement and activity is critical. Mindfulness-based practice is also very important. So I typically do some pranayama breathing exercises when I'm in my sauna for a period of time. I think meditation, gratitude is very important. All those things will help just overall wellness. Community is very important. That's another big thing with the Blue Zones. Having your tribe is important, and your tribe should be pushing you to further yourself so that you can learn and grow from. I personally strive to surround myself with individuals that I could just learn and grow from and that push me, whether it's at the gym or intellectually with medical conversation or socially with various topics, whatever it might be. So those are, I think, some of the things that we could adapt quality of life wise that I think that we could do to improve our aging trajectory as a whole. And there's a whole bunch of other toys that I could get into for biohacking, but that's a whole nother conversation.
I think it's a really important takeaway for those interested in healthy aging. It's not just the body. Our whole life, even our emotional state, our sense of community, impact the hallmarks and impacts our aging process.
I agree. And I think that removing obstacles to unlock that healing process is what we should be striving for daily. Once we get out of the way of ourselves, our body knows what to do to restore and get back to some level of homeodynamic balance.
Wonderful message. Such an empowering message too. We have a lot more control over these processes than sometimes we might think that we do.
Oh, yes. It's what we surround ourselves in. You know, the environment, we have these little antennas that connect to our DNA that receive these various signals and inputs from the environment. Zeitgebers and other signals influence how our body responds. It's very fascinating.
Thank you for sharing so much wisdom, so much really helpful, interesting information. I think this will help a lot of people connect the dots in different things that they're hearing about the aging process in different places. And I know we've only just scratched the surface here. There's just so much more to dive into and to know about each of these things. So we look forward in the future to doing a few of those deep dives with you into some of these specific topics.
Would love to.